Kill me and you will have your revenge.
I don't want revenge. I want my family.
Shallan wrapped her arms around herself and buried her head in them, weeping as the illusion bled white smoke, then vanished, leaving her in an empty room.
I can only conclude, Amaram wrote hurriedly, the glyphs a mess of sloppy ink, that we have been successful, Restaris. The reports from Dalinar's army indicate that Voidbringers were not only spotted but fought. Red Eyes, ancient powers. They have apparently unleashed a new storm upon this world. He looked up from his pad and peeked out the window. His carriage rattled down the roadway in Dalinar's war camp. All of his soldiers were away, and his remaining guards had gone to oversee the exodus. Even with Amaram's reputation, he'd been able to pass into the camp with ease. He turned back to his paper. "I do not exult in this success," he wrote. "Lives will be lost. It has ever been our burden as the sons of honor. To return the heralds, to return the dominance of the Church, we had to put the world into a crisis. That crisis we now have, a terrible one. The heralds will return. How can they not, with the problems we now face? But many will die. So very many. Nalan send that it is worth the loss. Regardless, I will have more information soon. When I next write you, I hope to do so from Urethiru." The coach pulled to a stop, and Amaram pushed open the door. He handed the letter to the carriage driver, Pama. She took it and began digging in her satchel for the span reed to send the communication to Restaris. He would have done it himself, but you could not use a span reed while moving. She would destroy the papers when done. Amaram spared a glance for the trunks on the back of the coach. They contained a precious cargo, including all of his maps, notes, and theories. Should he have left those with his soldiers? Bringing the force of 50 into Dalinar's war camp would have drawn attention for certain, even with the chaos here, so he'd ordered them to meet him on the plains. He needed to keep moving. He strode away from the coach, pulling up the hood on his cloak. The grounds of Dalinar's temple complex were even more frenzied than most of the war camps, as many people had come to the Ardens in this time of stress. He passed a mother begging for one of them to burn a prayer for her husband, who fought with Dalinar's army. The Arden kept repeating that she should gather her things and join the caravans heading out across the plains. It was happening. It was really happening. The Sons of Honor had, at long last, achieved their goal. Gavilar would be proud. Amaram hastened his pace, turning as another Ardent bustled up to him to ask if he needed anything. Before she could look in his hood and recognize him, however, her attention was drawn by a pair of frightened youths who complained that their father was too old to make the trip and begged for the Ardents to help them carry him somehow. He made it to the corner of the monastery building where they kept the insane and rounded to the back wall, out of sight, near the rim of the war camp itself. He looked about, then summoned his blade. A few swift slices would... What was that? He spun, certain he'd seen someone approach. But it was nothing. Shadows playing tricks on him. He made his slices in the wall and then carefully pushed open the hole he'd made. The Great One, Talenalot Ilin, herald of war himself, sat in the dark room in much the same posture he'd borne before. Perched on the end of his bed, slumped forward, head bowed.
"Why must they keep you in such darkness?" Amaram said, dismissing his blade. "This is not fit for the lowliest of men, let alone one such as yourself. I will have words with Dalinar about the way the insane are—"
No, he would not. Dalinar thought him a murderer. Amaram drew in a long, deep breath. Prices would need to be paid to see the heralds return, but by Yezzer Reza himself, the loss of Dalinar's friendship would be a stiff one indeed. Would that mercy had not stayed his hand all those months ago, when he could have executed that spearman? He hastened to the herald's side.
"Great prince," Amaram whispered, "we must go."
Talenalot did not move. He was whispering again, though, the same things as before. Amaram could not help being reminded of the last time he had visited this place, in the company of someone who had been playing him for one of the 10 fools all along. Who knew that Dalinar had grown so crafty in his old age? Time had changed both of them.
"Please, great prince,"
Amaram said, getting the herald to his feet with some difficulty. The man was enormous, as tall as Amaram, but built like a wall. The dark brown skin had surprised him the first time he'd seen the man. Amaram had somewhat foolishly expected that all of the heralds would look Alethi. The herald's dark eyes were, of course, some kind of disguise.
"The desolation,"
Talenalot whispered.
"Yes, it comes, and with it your return to glory."
Amaram began to walk the herald toward his opening. "We must get you to—" The herald's hand snapped up in front of him. Amaram started, freezing in place as he saw something in the herald's fingers, a small dart, the tip dripping with some clear liquid. Amaram glanced at the opening, which spilled sunlight into the room. A small figure there made a puffing sound, a blowgun held to his lips beneath a half-mask that covered the upper face. The herald's other hand shot out, quick as an eye blink, and snatched the dart from the air mere inches from Amaram's face.
The ghost bloods. They weren't trying to kill the herald. They were trying to kill Amaram.
He cried out, reaching his hand to the side, summoning his blade. Too slow. The figure looked from him to the herald, then scuttled away with a soft curse. Amaram chased after, leaping the rubble of the wall and breaking out into light, but the figure was moving too quickly. Heart thumping in his chest, he looked back toward Talenalot, worried for the herald's safety. Amaram started as he found the herald standing tall, straight-backed, head up. Dark brown eyes, startlingly lucid, reflected the light of the opening. Talenalot raised one dart before himself and inspected it. Then he dropped both darts and sat back down on his bed. His strange, unchanging mantra started over again, muttered. Amaram felt a chill run down his spine, but when he returned to the herald he could not get the man to respond. With effort, he made the herald rise again and ushered him to the coach. Zeth opened his eyes. He immediately squeezed them closed again.
"No! I died! I died!"
He felt rock beneath him. Blasphemy. He heard water dripping and felt the sun on his face.
"Why am I not dead?" he whispered. "The shard blade pierced me. I fell. Why didn't I die?"
"You did die." Zeth opened his eyes again. He lay in an empty rock expanse, his clothing a wet mess. The Frostlands? He felt cold, despite the heat of the sun. A man stood before him, wearing a crisp black and silver uniform. He had dark brown skin, like a man from the Makabaki region, but had a pale mark on his right cheek in the shape of a small, hooked crescent. He held one hand behind his back while his other hand tucked something away into his coat pocket. A fabrial of some sort? Glowing brightly?
"I recognize you," Zeth realized. "I've seen you somewhere before."
"You have." Zeth struggled to rise. He managed to make it to his knees, then knelt back on them.
"How?"
he asked.
"I waited until you crashed to the ground," the man said. "Until you were broken and mangled. Your soul cut through, dead for certain. Then I restored you."
"Impossible."
"Not if it is done before the brain dies. Like a drowned man restored to life with the proper ministrations, you could be restored with the right fabrial. If I had waited seconds longer, of course, it would have been too late."
He spoke the words calmly, without emotion.
"Who are you?"
Zeth asked.
"You spend this long obeying the precepts of your people and religion, yet you fail to recognize one of your gods."
"My gods are the spirits of the stones," Zeth whispered. "The sun and the stars, not men."
"Nonsense. Your people revere the Spren of Stone, but you do not worship them." That crescent. He recognized it, didn't he? You, Zeth, the man said, worship order, do you not? You follow the laws of your society to perfection. This attracted me, though I worry that emotion has clouded your ability to discern, your ability to judge. Judgment. Nin, he whispered, the one they call Nalan, or Nala here. Herald of Justice. Nin nodded. Why save me? Zeth said. Is my torment not enough? Those words are foolishness, Nin said. Unbecoming of one who would study beneath me. I don't want to study, Zeth said, curling up on the stone. I want to be dead. Is that it? Truly, that is what you wish most? I will give it to you, if that is your honest desire. Zeth squeezed his eyes shut. The screams awaited him in that darkness, the screams of those he'd killed. I was not wrong, he thought. I was never truthless. No, Zeth whispered. The Voidbringers have returned. I was right, and my people, they were wrong. You were banished by petty men with no vision. I will teach you the path of one uncorrupted by sentiment. You will bring this back to your people, and you will carry with you justice for the leaders of the Shin. Zeth opened his eyes and looked up. I am not worthy. Nin cocked his head. You? Not worthy? I watched you destroy yourself in the name of order, watched you obey your personal code when others would have fled or crumbled. Zeth, son Naturo, I watched you keep your word with perfection. This is a thing lost to most people. It is the only genuine beauty in the world. I doubt I have ever found a man more worthy of the Skybreakers than you. The Skybreakers? But that was an order of the Knights Radiant. I have destroyed myself, Zeth whispered. You did? And you died. Your bond to your blade severed. All ties, both spiritual and physical, undone. You are reborn. Come along. It is time to visit your people. Your training begins immediately. Nin began to walk away, revealing that the thing he held behind his back was a sheathed sword. You are reborn. Could Zeth be reborn? Could he make the screams in the shadows go away? You are a coward, the Radiant had said, the man who owned the winds. A small piece of Zeth thought it true. But Nin offered more, something different. Still kneeling, Zeth looked up after the man. My people have the other honor blades, and have kept them safe for millennia. If I am to bring judgment to them, I will face enemies with shards and with power. This is not a problem, Nin said, looking back. I have brought a shard blade for you, one that is a perfect match for your task and temperament. He tossed his large sword to the ground. It skidded on stone and came to rest before Zeth. He had not seen a sword with a metal sheath before. And who sheathed a shard blade? And the blade itself? Was it black? An inch or so of it had emerged from the sheath as it slid on the rocks. Zeth swore he could see a small trail of black smoke coming off the metal. Like stormlight, only dark. Hello, a cheerful voice said in his mind. Would you like to destroy some evil today? 89. The Four. There has to be an answer. What is the answer? Stop the Parshendi, one of them. Yes, they are the missing piece. Push for the Alethi to destroy them outright before this one obtains their power.
It will form a bridge. From the diagram, floorboard 17, paragraph 2, every second letter starting with the second. Dalinar stood in darkness. He turned about, trying to remember how he'd come to this place. In the shadows, he saw furniture. Tables, a rug, drapes from Aesir with wild colors. His mother had always been proud of those drapes.
My home, he thought, as it was when I was a child.
Back before conquest, back before Gavilar.
Gavilar? Hadn't Gavilar died?
No, Dalinar could hear his brother laughing in the next room. He was a child, they both were. Dalinar crossed the shadowed room, feeling the fuzzy joy of familiarity, of things being as they should be. He'd left his wooden swords out. He had a collection, each carved like a shard blade. He was too old for those now, of course, but he still liked having them, as a collection. He stepped to the balcony doors and pushed them open. Warm light bathed him. A deep, enveloping, piercing warmth. A warmth that soaked down deep through his skin into his very self. He stared at that light and was not blinded. The source was distant, but he knew it. Knew it well. He smiled. Then he awoke, alone in his new rooms in Urethiru, a temporary location for him to stay while they scouted the entire tower. A week had passed since they had arrived at this place, and the people of the war camps had finally started to arrive, bearing spheres recharged during the unexpected high storm. They needed those badly to make the Oath Gate function. Those from the war camps arrived none too soon. The Everstorm had not yet returned, but if it moved like a regular high storm, it should be striking any day now. Dalinar sat in the darkness for a short time, contemplating that warmth he had felt. What had that been? It had been an odd time to get one of the visions. They always came during high storms. Before, when he'd felt one coming on while sleeping, it had awakened him. He checked with his guards. No high storm was blowing. Contemplative, he started to dress. He wanted to see if he could get out onto the roof of the tower today. As Adolin walked the dark halls of Urethiru, he tried not to show how overwhelmed he felt. The world had just shifted, like a door on its hinges. A few days ago, his causal betrothal had been that of a powerful man to a relatively minor scion of a distant house. Now Shallan might be the most important person in the world, and he was... What was he? He raised his lantern, then made a few marks in chalk on the wall to indicate he'd been here. This tower was huge. How did the entire thing stay up? They could probably explore in here for months without opening every door. He had thrown himself into the duty of exploration because it seemed like something he could do. It also, unfortunately, gave him time to think. He didn't like how few answers he came up with. He turned around, realizing he'd gotten far from the rest of his scouting party. He was doing that more and more often. The first groups from the Shattered Plains had started arriving, and they needed to decide where to house everyone. Were those voices ahead? Adolin frowned, then continued down the corridor, leaving his lantern behind, so it wouldn't give him away. He was surprised when he recognized one of the speakers down the hallway. Was that Sadeus? It was. The High Prince stood with a scouting party of his own. Silently, Adolin cursed the wind that had persuaded Sadeus, of all people, to heed the call to come to Urethiru. Everything would have been so much easier if he'd just stayed behind. Sadeus gestured for a few of his soldiers to go down one branch of the tunnel-like corridor. His wife and a few of her scribes went the other way, two soldiers trailing. Adolin watched for a moment as the High Prince himself raised a lantern, inspecting a faded painting on the wall. A fanciful picture, with animals from mythology.
He recognized a few from children's stories, like the enormous mink-like creature with the mane of hair that burst out around and behind its head. What was it called again? Adolin turned to go, but his boot scraped stone. Sadeus spun, raising his lantern.
Ah, Prince Adolin.
He wore white, which really didn't help his complexion. The pale color made his ruddy features seem downright bloody by comparison.
Sadeus, Adolin said, turning back.
I wasn't aware that you had arrived.
Storming man. He'd ignored Father all those months, and now he decided to obey. The High Prince strolled up the hallway, passing Adolin.
This place is remarkable. Remarkable indeed.
So you acknowledge that my father was right, Adolin said.
That his visions are true. The Voidbringers have returned, and you are made a fool. I will admit, Sadeus said, there is more fight left to your father than I'd once feared. A remarkable plan. Contacting the Parshendi, working out this deal with them. They put on quite a show, I hear. It certainly convinced Aladar.
You can't possibly believe it was all a show.
Oh, please. You deny that he had a Parshendi among his own guard? Isn't it convenient that these new Radiants include the head of Dalinar's guard and your own betrothed?
Sadeus smiled, and Adolin saw the truth. No, he didn't believe this, but it was the lie he would tell. He would start the whisperings again, trying to undermine Dalinar.
Why? Adolin asked, stepping up to him. Why are you like this, Sadeus?
Because, Sadeus said with a sigh, it has to happen. You can't have an army with two generals, son. Your father and I, we're two old white spines who both want a kingdom. It's him or me. We've been pointed that way since Gavilar died.
It doesn't have to be that way.
It does. Your father will never trust me again, Adolin, and you know it.
Sadeus's face darkened.
I will take this from him. This city, these discoveries. It's just a setback.
Adolin stood for a moment, staring Sadeus in the eyes, and then something finally snapped.
That's it.
Adolin grabbed Sadeus by the throat with his unwounded hand, slamming the High Prince back against the wall. The look of utter shock on Sadeus's face amused a part of Adolin, the very small part that wasn't completely, totally, and irrevocably enraged. He squeezed, choking off a cry for help as he moved to pin Sadeus back against the wall, grabbing the man's arm with his own. But Sadeus was a trained soldier. He tried to break the hold, taking Adolin by the arm and twisting. Adolin kept hold, but lost his balance. The two of them fell in a jumble, twisting, rolling. This wasn't the calculated intensity of the dueling grounds, or even the methodical butchery of the battlefield. This was two sweating, straining men, both on the edge of panic. Adolin was younger, but he was still bruised from the fight with the assassin in white. He managed to come up on top, and as Sadeus struggled to yell, Adolin slammed the man's head down against the stone floor to daze him. Breathing in gasps, Adolin grabbed his side knife. He plunged the knife toward Sadeus's face, though the man managed to get his hands up to grab Adolin by the wrist. Adolin grunted, forcing the knife closer, clutched in his off hand. He brought the right in anyway, the wrist flaring with pain, as he leaned it against the crossguard. Sweat prickled on Sadeus's brow, the knife's tip touching the end of his left nostril.
My father,
Adolin said with a grunt, sweat from his nose dripping down onto the blade of the knife.
Thinks I'm a better man than he is.
He strained and felt Sadeus's grip weaken.
Unfortunately for you, he's wrong.
Sadeus whimpered. With a surge, Adolin forced the blade up past Sadeus's nose and into his eye socket, piercing the eye like a ripe berry, then rammed it home into the brain.
Sadeus shook for a moment, blood pulling around the blade as Adolin worked it to be certain. A second later, a shard blade appeared beside Sadeus, his father's shard blade. Sadeus was dead. Adolin stumbled back to not get blood on his clothing, though his cuffs were already stained.
Storms! Had he just done that? Had he just murdered a high prince?
Dazed, he stared at that weapon. Neither man had summoned his blade for the fight. The weapons might be worth a fortune, but they'd do less good than a rock in such a close-quarters fight. Thoughts coming more clearly, Adolin picked up the weapon and stumbled away. He ditched the blade out a window, dropping it down into one of the planter-like outcroppings of the terrace below. It might be safe there. After that, he had the presence of mind to cut off his cuffs, remove his chalk mark on the wall by scraping it free with his own blade, and walk as far away as he could before finding one of his scouting parties and pretending he'd been in that area all along. Dalinar finally figured out the locking mechanism, then pushed on the metal door at the end of the stairwell. The door was set into the ceiling here, the steps running straight up to it. The trap door refused to open despite being unlocked. He'd oiled the parts. Why wasn't it moving?
Krem, of course, he thought.
He summoned his shard blade and made a series of quick cuts along the trap door. Then, with an effort, he was able to force it open. The ancient trap door swung upward and let him out onto the very top of the Tower City. He smiled, stepping onto the roof. 5 days of exploration had sent Adolin and Navani into the depths of the city tower. Dalinar, however, had been driven to seek the top. For such an enormous tower, the roof was actually relatively small and not that encrusted with creme. This high, less rain likely dropped during high storms, and everyone knew creme was thicker in the east than it was in the west.
Storms, this place was high.
His ears had popped several times while riding to the top, using the fabrial lift that Navani had discovered. She spoke of counterweights and conjoined gemstones, sounding awed by the technology of the ancients. All he knew was that her discovery had let him avoid climbing up some 100 flights of steps. He stepped up to the edge and looked down. Below, each ring of the tower expanded out a little farther than the one above it.
Shallan is right, he thought. They're gardens. Each outer ring is dedicated to planting food.
He did not know why the eastern face of the tower was straight and sheer, facing the origin. No balconies along that side. He leaned out. Distant, so far down it made him queasy, he picked out the 10 pillars that held the oath gates. The one to the shattered plains flashed, and a large group of people appeared on it. They flew Hatham's flag. With the maps Dalinar's scholars had sent, it had only taken Hatham and the others about a week of quick marching to reach the oath gate. When Dalinar's army had crossed that same distance, they'd done so very cautiously, wary of Parshendi attacks. Now that he saw those pillars from this perspective, he recognized that there was one of them in Kolinar. It made up the dais upon which the palace and royal temple had been built. Shallan suspected that Yasna had tried to open the oath gate there. The woman's notes said that oath gates to each of the cities were locked tight. Only the one in the shattered plains had been left open. Shallan hoped to figure out how to use the others, though their tests right now showed them to be locked somehow. If she managed to make them work, the world would become a much, much smaller place. Assuming there was anything left of it. Dalinar turned and looked upward regarding the sky. He took a deep breath. This was why he had come to the top.
"You sent that storm to destroy us," he shouted toward the clouds. "You sent it to cover up what Shallan and then Kaladin were becoming. You tried to end this before it could begin."
Silence.
"Why send me visions and tell me to prepare?" Dalinar shouted. "Then try to destroy us when we listen to them."
"I was required to send those visions once the time arrived,"
The Almighty demanded it of me. I could no more disobey than I could refuse to blow the winds.
Dalinar breathed in deeply. The Stormfather had replied. Blessedly, he had replied.
The visions were his, then, Dalinar said. And you the vehicle for choosing who received them?
Yes.
Why did you pick me?
Dalinar demanded.
It does not matter. You were too slow. You failed. The Everstorm is here, and the Spren of the enemy come to inhabit the Ancient Ones. It is over. You have lost.
You said that you were a fragment of the Almighty.
I am his Spren, you might say. Not his soul. I am the memory men create for him, now that he is gone. The personification of storms and of the divine. I am no god. I am but a shadow of one.
I'll take what I can get.
He wished for me to find you, but your kind have brought only death to mine.
What do you know of this storm that the Parshendi unleashed?
The Everstorm. It is a new thing, but old of design. It rounds the world now and carries with it his Spren. Any of the old people it touches will take on their new forms.
Voidbringers.
That is one term for them.
This Everstorm will come again? For certain?
Regularly like high storms, though less frequent. You are doomed.
And it will transform the Parshmen.
Is there no way to stop it? No.
Dalinar closed his eyes. It was as he had feared. His army had defeated the Parshendi, yes, but they were only a fraction of what was coming. Soon he would face hundreds of thousands of them. The other lands weren't listening. He'd managed to speak via Spanreed with the Emperor of Aesir himself, a new emperor, as Zeth had visited the last one. There had been no succession war in Aesir, of course. Those required too much paperwork. The new emperor had invited Dalinar to visit, but obviously considered his words to be ravings. Dalinar hadn't realized that rumors of his madness had traveled so far. Even without that, he suspected his warnings would be ignored, as the things he spoke of were insane. A storm that blew the wrong way? Parshmen turning into Voidbringers? Only Taravangian of Carbranth, and now apparently Yakaved, had seemed willing to listen. Heralds bless that man. Hopefully he could bring some peace to that tortured land. Dalinar had asked for more information about how he'd obtained that throne. Initial reports indicated he'd stumbled into the position unexpectedly. But he was too new, and Yakaved too broken for him to be able to do much. Beyond that, there were sudden and unexpected reports coming via Spanreed of Kolinar rioting. No straight answers there yet, either. And what was this he heard of a plague in the Pure Lake? Storms, what a mess this all had become. He would need to do something about it. All of it. Dalinar looked to the sky again.
I have been commanded to refound the Knights Radiant. I will need to join their number if I am to lead them.
Distant thunder rumbled in the sky, though there were no clouds.
Life before death, Dalinar shouted. Strength before weakness. Journey before destination. I am the sliver of the Almighty himself,
the voice said, sounding angry.
I am the Storm Father. I will not let myself be bound in such a way as to kill me.
I need you, Dalinar said,
despite what you did.
The Bridgeman spoke of oaths given, and of each order of knights being different. The first ideal is the same. After that, each order is unique, requiring different words.
The thunder rumbled. It sounded like a challenge. Could Dalinar interpret thunder now? This was a dangerous gambit. He confronted something primal, something unknowable, something that had actively tried to murder him and his entire army.
"Fortunately," Dalinar said, "I know the second oath I am to make. I don't need to be told it. I will unite instead of divide, Stormfather. I will bring men together."
The thunder silenced. Dalinar stood alone, staring at the sky, waiting.
"Very well," the Stormfather finally said. "These words are accepted."
Dalinar smiled.
"I will not be a simple sword to you," the Stormfather warned. "I will not come as you call, and you will have to divest yourself of that monstrosity that you carry. You will be a radiant with no shards."
"It will be what it must," Dalinar said, summoning his shard blade. As soon as it appeared, screams sounded in his head. He dropped the weapon as if it were an eel that had snapped at him. The screams vanished immediately. The blade clanged to the ground. Unbonding a shard blade was supposed to be a difficult process, requiring concentration and touching its stone. Yet this one was severed from him in an instant. He could feel it.
"What was the meaning of the last vision I received?" Dalinar said. "The one this morning. It came with no high storm."
"No vision was sent this morning."
"Yes, it was. I saw light and warmth."
"A simple dream. Not of me nor of gods."
Curious. Dalinar could have sworn it felt the same way as the visions, if not stronger.
"Go, Bondsmith," the Stormfather said. "Lead your dying people to failure. Odium destroyed the Almighty himself. You are nothing to him."
"The Almighty could die," Dalinar said.
"If that is true, then this Odium can be killed. I will find a way to do it.
The visions mentioned a challenge, a champion. Do you know anything of this?"
The sky gave no reply beyond a simple rumble. Well, there would be time for more questions later. Dalinar walked down off the tower of Urethiru and entered the stairwell again. The flight of steps opened into a room that encompassed nearly the entire top floor of the tower city, and it shone with light through glass windows. Glass, with no shutters or support, some of it facing east. How it survived high storms, Dalinar did not know, though lines of creme did streak it in places. 10 short pillars ringed this room, with another at the center. "Well?" Kaladin asked, turning away from an inspection of one of them. Shallan rounded another. She looked far less ragged than she had when they'd first come to the city. Though their days here in Urethiru had been frantic, some good night's sleep had served them all quite well. In response to the question, Dalinar took a sphere from his pocket and held it up. Then he sucked in the stormlight. He knew to expect the feeling of a storm raging inside, as both Kaladin and Shallan had described it to him. It urged him to act, to move, to not stand still. It did not, however, feel like the thrill of battle, which was what he had anticipated. He felt his wounds healing in a familiar way. He'd done this before, he sensed. On the battlefield earlier? His arm felt fine now, and the cut on his side barely ached anymore. "It's horribly unfair you managed that on your first try," Kaladin noted. "It took me forever."
"I had instruction," Dalinar said, walking into the room and tucking the sphere away. "The Stormfather called me Bondsmith."
"It was the name of one of the orders," Shallan said, resting her fingers on one of the pillars. "That makes three of us. Windrunner, Bondsmith, Lightweaver." For,
a voice said from the shadows of the stairwell. Renarin stepped up into the lit room. He looked at them, then shrank back.
Son? Delinar asked.
Renarin remained in the darkness, looking down.
No spectacles, Delinar whispered. You stopped wearing them. I thought you were trying to look like a warrior, but no. Stormlight healed your eyes.
Renarin nodded.
And the Shardblade, Delinar said, stepping over and taking his son by the shoulder. You hear screams. That's what happened to you in the arena. You couldn't fight because of those shouts in your head from summoning the blade. Why? Why didn't you say anything?
I thought it was me,
Renarin whispered.
My mind. But Gliss, he says...
Renarin blinked.
Truth Watcher.
Truth Watcher?
Kaladin said, glancing at Shallan. She shook her head.
I walk the winds, she weaves light. Bright Lord Delinar forges bonds. What do you do?
Renarin met Kaladin's eyes across the room.
I see.
Four orders, Delinar said, squeezing Renarin's shoulder with pride.
Storms, the lad was trembling. What made him so worried? Delinar turned to the others.
The other orders must be returning as well. We need to find those whom the Spren have chosen. Quickly, for the Everstorm is upon us, and it is worse than we feared.
How?
Shallan asked.
It will change the Parshmen, Delinar said. The Stormfather confirmed it to me. When that storm hits, it will bring back the Voidbringers.
Damnation, Kaladin said. I need to get to Alethkar, to Hearthstone.
He strode toward the exit.
Soldier,
Delinar called.
I've done what I can to warn our people.
My parents are back there, Kaladin said. And the city lord of my town has Parshmen. I'm going. How?
Shallan asked.
You'll fly the entire distance?
Fall, Kaladin said, but yes. He paused at the doorway out.
How much light will that take, son? Delinar asked.
I don't know,
Kaladin admitted.
A lot, probably.
Shallan looked to Delinar. They didn't have stormlight to spare. Though those from the war camps brought recharged spheres, activating the Oath Gate took a great deal of stormlight, depending on how many people were brought. Lighting the lamps in the room at the center of the Oath Gate was merely the minimum amount needed to start the device. Bringing many people partially drained the infused gemstones they carried as well.
I will get you what I can, lad, Delinar said. Go with my blessing. Perhaps you will have enough left over to get to the capital afterward and help the people there.
Kaladin nodded.
I'll put together a pack. I need to leave within the hour.
He ducked from the room and into the stairwell down. Delinar sucked in more stormlight and felt the last of his wounds retreat. This seemed a thing a man could easily grow accustomed to having. He sent Renarin with orders to speak with the king and requisition some emerald bromes that Kaladin could borrow for his trip. Elokar had finally arrived in the company of a group of Herdasians, of all things, one claiming his name needed to be added to the lists of Alethi kings. Renarin went eagerly to obey the order. He seemed to want something he could do.
He's one of the Knights Radiant, Delinar thought, watching him go. I'll probably need to stop sending him on errands.
Storms. It was really happening. Shallan had walked to the windows. Delinar stepped up beside her. This was the eastern face of the tower, the flat edge that looked directly toward the origin.
Kaladin will only have time to save a few, Shallan said. If that many. There are four of us, Bright Lord. Only four against a storm full of destruction.
It is what it is.
So many will die.
And we will save the ones we can, Delinar said.
He turned to her.
Life before death, Radiant. It is the task to which we are now sworn.
She pursed her lips, still looking eastward, but nodded.
Life before death, radiant.
Epilogue. Art and expectation.
A blind man awaited the era of endings, Witt said, contemplating the beauty of nature.
Silence.
That man is me, Witt noted. I'm not physically blind, just spiritually. And that other statement was actually very clever if you think about it.
Silence.
This is a lot more satisfying, he said, when I have intelligent life whom I can render awed, wrapped with attention for my clever verbosity.
The ugly lizard crab thing on the next rock over clicked its claw, an almost hesitant sound.
You're right, of course, Witt said. My usual audience isn't particularly intelligent. That was also the obvious joke, however, so shame on you.
The ugly lizard crab thing scuttled across its rock, moving on to the other side. Witt sighed.
It was night, which was normally a good time for dramatic arrivals and meaningful philosophy.
Unfortunately for him, there was nobody here upon which to philosophize or visit, dramatically or otherwise. A small river gurgled nearby, one of the few permanent waterways in this strange land. Extending in all directions were rolling hills furrowed by passing water and grown over in the valleys with an odd kind of briar. Very few trees here, though farther west a true forest sprouted on the slopes down from the heights. A couple of songlings made rattling sounds nearby, and he took out his pipes and tried to imitate them. He couldn't. Not exactly. The singing sounds were too like percussion, a zipping rattle. Musical, but not flute-like. Still, the creatures seemed to alternate with him, responding to his music. Who knew? Maybe the things had a rudimentary intelligence. Those horses, the Rashadium, those had surprised him. He was glad that there were still some things that could do that. He finally set down his pipes and contemplated. An audience of ugly lizard crab things and songlings was some audience, at least.
Art, he said, is fundamentally unfair.
One songling continued to creak.
You see, we pretend that art is eternal, that there is some kind of persistence to it. A truth, you might say. Art is art because it is art, and not because we say that it is art. I'm not going too quickly for you, am I?
Creak.
Good. But if art is eternal and meaningful and independent, why does it depend so damn much upon the audience? You've heard the story about the farmer visiting court during the Festival of Depiction, right?
Creak.
Oh, it's not that great a story. Utterly disposable. Standard beginning, the farmer who visits the big city, does something embarrassing, stumbles into the princess, and, completely by accident, saves her from getting trampled. Princesses in these stories never do seem to be able to look where they are going. I think perhaps more of them should inquire with a reputable lens maker and procure a suitable set of spectacles before attempting any further traversal of thoroughfares. Anyway, as this story is a comedy, the man is invited to the palace for a reward. Various nonsense follows, ending with the poor farmer wiping himself in the privy with one of the finest paintings ever painted, then strolling out to find all of the light eyes staring at an empty frame and commenting on how beautiful the work is. Mirth and guffaws flourish and bow, exit before anyone thinks too much about the tale.
He waited.
Creak? Well, don't you see, Witt said. The farmer found the painting near the privy, so assumed it was to be used for such a purpose. The light eyes found the empty frame in the Hall of Art and assumed it to be a masterwork. You may call this a silly story. It is. That does not deprecate its truthfulness. After all, I am frequently quite silly, but I am almost always truthful. Force of habit. Expectation. That is the true soul of art. If you can give a man more than he expects, then he will laud you his entire life. If you can create an air of anticipation and feed it properly, you will succeed. Conversely, if you gain a reputation for being too good, too skilled, beware.
the better art will be in their heads, and if you give them an ounce less than they imagined, suddenly you have failed. Suddenly you are useless. A man will find a single coin in the mud and talk about it for days, but when his inheritance comes and is accounted 1% less than he expected, then he will declare himself cheated.
Witt shook his head, standing up and dusting off his coat.
Give me an audience who have come to be entertained, but who expect nothing special. To them, I will be a god. That is the best truth I know.
Silence.
I could use a little music, he said. For dramatic effect, you see. Someone is coming, and I want to be prepared to welcome them.
The songling, obligingly, started its music again. Witt took a deep breath, then struck the appropriate pose. Lazy expectation, calculated knowingness, insufferable conceit. After all, he did have a reputation, so he might as well try to live up to it. The air in front of him blurred, as if heated in a ring near the ground. A streak of light spun upon the ring, forming a wall 5 or 6 feet high. It faded immediately. Really, it was just an afterimage, as if something glowing had spun in the circle very quickly. In the center of it appeared Jasna Kolin, standing tall. Her clothing was ragged, her hair formed into a single utilitarian braid, her face lashed with burns. She'd once worn a fine dress, but that was tattered. She'd hemmed it at the knees and had sewn herself a glove out of something improvised. Curiously, she wore a kind of leather bandolier and a backpack. He doubted she'd had either one when her journey had begun. She groaned a long groan, then looked to the side where Witt stood. He grinned at her. She stabbed her hand out in a blink of an eye, mist twisting around her arm and snapping into the form of a long, thin sword, pointed at Witt's neck. He cocked an eyebrow.
"How did you find me?" she asked. "You've been making quite a disturbance on the other side," Witt said. "It's been a long time since the Spren had to deal with someone alive, particularly someone so demanding as yourself."
She hissed out a breath, then pushed the shard blade closer.
"Tell me what you know, Witt." "I once spent the better part of a year inside of a large stomach, being digested."
She frowned at him.
"That is a thing that I know. You really should be more specific in your threats."
He looked down as she twisted her shard blade, rotating the tip, still pointed at him.
"I'd be surprised if that little knife of yours poses me any real threat, Kolin. You can keep waving it about if you want, though. Perhaps it makes you feel more important."
She studied him. Then the sword burst to mist, vaporizing. She lowered her arm.
"I don't have time for you. A storm is coming, a terrible storm. It will bring the Voidbringers to..."
"Already here."
"Damnation. We need to find Urethiru and..."
"Already found." She hesitated.
"The knights..."
"Refounded," Witt said. "In part by your apprentice, who, I might add, is exactly 77% more agreeable than you are." I took a poll.
"You're lying."
"Okay, so it was a rather informal poll. But the ugly lizard crab thing gave you really poor marks for..."
"About the other things." "I don't tell those kinds of lies, Jasna. You know that. It's what you find so annoying about me."
She inspected him, then sighed.
"It is part of what I find so annoying about you, Witt. Only a very small part of a vast, vast river."
"You only say that because you don't know me very well."
"Doubtful." "No, really. If you did know me, that river of annoyance would be an ocean, obviously."
"Regardless, I know things that you do not, and I think you might actually know some that I do not. That gives us what is called synergy. If you can contain your annoyance, we might both learn something."
She looked him up and down, then drew her lips to a line and nodded.
She started walking directly toward the nearest town. She had a good sense of direction, this woman. Witt strolled up beside her.
"You realize we're at least a week away from civilization. Do you need to else call this far out in the middle of nowhere?"
I was somewhat pressed at the time of my escape. I'm lucky to be here at all.
Lucky? I don't know if I'd say that.
Why? You'd likely be better off on the other side, Jasnah Kulin. The desolation has come, and with it the end of this land. He looked at her. I'm sorry. Don't be sorry, she said, until we see how much I can salvage. The storm has come already? The parchment have transformed?
Yes and no, Wit said. The storm should hit Shinovar tonight, then work its way across the land. I believe that the storm will bring the transformation.
Jasnah stopped in place. That's not how it happened in the past. I have learned things on the other side.
You are correct.
It is different this time. She licked her lips, but otherwise did a good job of containing her anxiety. If it's not happening as it did before, then everything I know could be false. The words of the High Spren could be inaccurate. The records I seek could be meaningless. He nodded. We can't depend upon the ancient writings, she said, and the supposed god of men is a fabrication. So we can't look to the heavens for salvation, but apparently we can't look toward the past either. So where can we look?
You're so convinced that there is no god.
The Almighty is...
Oh, Wit said, I don't mean the Almighty. Tanavast was a fine enough fellow, bought me drinks once, but he was not god.
I'll admit, Jasnah, that I empathize with your skepticism, but I don't agree with it. I just think you've been looking for God in all the wrong places.
I suppose that you're going to tell me where you think I should look.
You'll find God in the same place you're going to find salvation from this mess, Wit said. Inside the hearts of men.
Curiously, Jasnah said, I believe I can actually agree with that, though I suspect for different reasons than you imply. Perhaps this walk won't be as bad as I had feared.
Perhaps, he said, looking up toward the stars. Whatever else might be said, at least the world chose a nice night upon which to end.
The end of Book 2 of the Stormlight Archive. End note.
Alight. Winds approach, deadly approaching winds alight. This catch, written on Light Day, Yesesis, 1174, adorns the cover of Navani Kolin's personal journal. Inside, she describes firsthand the events leading to the arrival of the Everstorm. The glyphs of the catch were drawn in the shape of two storms crashing into one another. Naz.
Ars Arcanum. The Ten Essences and Their Historical Associations. Number. Gemstone. Essence. Body Focus. Soul Casting Properties. Primary, Secondary, Divine Attributes. 1. Yes. Sapphire. Zephyr. Inhalation. Translucent Gas, Air. Protecting, Leading. 2. Nan. Smokestone. Vapor. Exhalation. Opaque Gas, Smoke, Fog. Just. Confident. 3. Chach. Ruby. Spark. The Soul. Fire. Brave. Obedient. 4. Vev. Diamond. Lucentia. The Eyes. Quartz. Glass. Crystal. Loving. Healing. 5. Pala. Emerald. Pulp. The Hair. Wood. Plants. Moss. Learned. Giving. 6. Shash. Garnet. Blood. The Blood. Blood. All non-oil liquid. Creative. Honest. 7. Betab, zircon, tallow, oil, all kinds of oil. Wise, careful. 8. Cock, amethyst, foil, the nails, metal, resolute, builder. 9. Tanat, topaz, talus, the bone, rock and stone, dependable, resourceful. 10. Ishi, heliodor, sinew, flesh, meats, flesh, pious, guiding. The preceding list is an imperfect gathering of traditional Vorin symbolism associated with the 10 essences. Bound together, these form the double eye of the Almighty, an eye with 2 pupils, representing the creation of plants and creatures. This is also the basis for the hourglass shape that was often associated with the night's radiant. Ancient scholars also placed the 10 orders of night's radiant on this list, along with the heralds themselves, who each had a classical association with one of the numbers and essences. I'm not certain yet how the 10 levels of void binding or its cousin the old magic fit into this paradigm, if indeed they can. My research suggests that indeed there should be another series of abilities that is even more esoteric than the void bindings. Perhaps the old magic fits into those, though I am beginning to suspect that it is something entirely different. Note that I currently believe the concept of the body focus to be more a matter of philosophical interpretation than an actual attribute of this investiture and its manifestations. The 10 surges. As a complement to the essences, the classical elements celebrated on Roshar are found the 10 surges. These, thought to be the fundamental forces by which the world operates, are more accurately a representation of the 10 basic abilities offered to the heralds, and then the knights radiant, by their bonds. Adhesion, the surge of pressure and vacuum. Gravitation, the surge of gravity. Division, the surge of destruction and decay. Abrasion, the surge of friction. Progression, the surge of growth and healing or regrowth. Illumination, the surge of light, sound, and various waveforms. Transformation, the surge of soul casting. Transportation, the surge of motion and realmatic transition. Cohesion, the surge of strong axial interconnection. Tension, the surge of soft axial interconnection. On the creation of fabrials, 5 groupings of fabrial have been discovered so far. The methods of their creation are carefully guarded by the Artifabrian community, but they appear to be the work of dedicated scientists, as opposed to the more mystical surge bindings once performed by the Knights Radiant. I am more and more convinced that the creation of these devices requires forced enslavement of transformative cognitive entities known as Spren to the local communities. Altering fabrials. Augmenters. These fabrials are crafted to enhance something. They can create heat, pain, or even a calm wind, for instance. They are powered, like all fabrials, by stormlight. They seem to work best with forces, emotions, or sensations. The so-called half-shards of Yakaved are created with this type of fabrial attached to a sheet of metal, enhancing its durability. I have seen fabrials of this type crafted using many different types of gemstone. I am guessing that any one of the 10 pole stones will work. Diminishers. These fabrials do the opposite of what augmenters do, and generally seem to fall under the same restrictions as their cousins. Those Artifabrians who have taken me into confidence seem to believe that even greater fabrials are possible, than what have been created so far, particularly in regard to augmenters and diminishers. Pairing fabrials. Conjoiners. By infusing a ruby and using methodology that has not been revealed to me, though I have my suspicions, you can create a conjoined pair of gemstones. The process requires splitting the original ruby. The two halves will then create parallel reactions across a distance. Span reeds are one of the most common forms of this type of fabrial. Conservation of force is maintained. For instance, if one is attached to a heavy stone, you will need the same strength to lift the conjoined fabrial that you would need to lift the stone itself. There appears to be some sort of process used during the creation of the fabrial that influences how far apart the two halves can go and still produce an effect. Reversers. Using an amethyst instead of a ruby also creates conjoined halves of a gemstone, but these two work in creating opposite reactions. Raise one and the other will be pressed downward, for instance. These fabrials have only just been discovered, and already the possibilities for exploitation are being conjectured. There appear to be some unexpected limitations to this form of fabrial, though I have not been able to discover what they are. Warning fabrials. There is only one type of fabrial in this set, informally known as the alerter. An alerter can warn one of a nearby object, feeling, sensation, or phenomenon. These fabrials use a heliodor stone as their focus. I do not know whether this is the only type of gemstone that will work, or if there is another reason heliodor is used. In the case of this kind of fabrial, the amount of stormlight you can infuse into it affects its range. Hence, the size of gemstone used is very important. Wind running and lashings. Reports of the assassin in White's odd abilities have led me to some sources of information that I believe are generally unknown. The Wind Runners were an order of the Knights Radiant, and they made use of two primary types of surge binding. The effects of these surge bindings were known, colloquially among the members of the order, as the Three Lashings. Basic lashing, gravitational change. This type of lashing was one of the most commonly used lashings among the Order, though it was not the easiest to use. That distinction belongs to the full lashing below. A basic lashing involved revoking a being's or object's spiritual gravitational bond to the planet below, instead temporarily linking that being or object to a different object or direction. Effectively, this creates a change in gravitational pull, twisting the energies of the planet itself. A basic lashing allowed a windrunner to run up walls, to send objects or people flying off into the air, or to create similar effects. Advanced uses of this type of lashing would allow a windrunner to make himself or herself lighter by binding part of his or her mass upward. Mathematically, binding a quarter of one's mass upward would halve a person's effective weight. Binding half of one's mass upward would create weightlessness. Multiple basic lashings could also pull an object or a person's body downward at double, triple, or other multiples of its weight. Full lashing. Binding objects together. A full lashing might seem very similar to a basic lashing, but they worked on very different principles. While one had to do with gravitation, the other had to do with the force, or surge, as the Radiants called them, of adhesion, binding objects together as if they were one. I believe this surge may have had something to do with atmospheric pressure. To create a full lashing, a windrunner would infuse an object with stormlight, then press another object to it. The two objects would become bound together with an extremely powerful bond, nearly impossible to break. In fact, most materials would themselves break before the bond holding them together would. Reverse lashing. Giving an object a gravitational pull. I believe this may actually be a specialized version of the basic lashing. This type of lashing required the least amount of stormlight of any of the three lashings. The Windrunner would infuse something, give a mental command, and create a pull to the object that yanked other objects toward it. At its heart, this lashing created a bubble around the object that imitated its spiritual link to the ground beneath it. As such, it was much harder for the lashing to affect objects touching the ground, where their link to the planet was strongest. Objects falling or in flight were the easiest to influence. Other objects could be affected, but the stormlight and skill required were much more substantial. Light weaving. A second form of surge binding involves the manipulation of light and sound in illusory tactics common throughout the Cosmere. Unlike the variations present on Cell, however, this method has a powerful spiritual element, requiring not just a full mental picture of the intended creation, but some level of connection to it as well. The illusion is based not simply upon what the light weaver imagines, but upon what they desire to create. In many ways, this is the most similar ability to the original Yolish variant, which excites me. I wish to delve more into this ability, with the hope to gain a full understanding of how it relates to cognitive and spiritual attributes.
We hope you have enjoyed Words of Radiance, Book 2 of the Stormlight Archive, a Macmillan audio production from Tor Books. Text copyright 2014 by Dragonsteel Entertainment, LLC. Production copyright 2014 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.